950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome into the Friday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Here's what's coming up on the show today. As I've talked about for the past few shows, on election night, I really would like to highlight some of the races that are probably going to fly under the radar nationally, but could still have a big impact on our political system. I was highlighting the North Carolina legislature, what's happening in Wisconsin and Ohio, but also Texas as well. And coming up, we are going to be speaking with Kendall Scudder. He is the co-host of the podcast called Pod Bless Texas, as we're going to be focusing on some of the legislative races in that state. Now, you might be sitting there and thinking, well, why are we focusing on what's happening in Texas? Well, obviously, it's a huge state that has a ton of congressional seats and is expected to gain even more congressional seats after the census. But what's also key is that Texas has been gerrymandered significantly for the past decade, and this time Democrats have a very real chance of retaking their state House of Representatives, and if that happens, no more gerrymandering in that state, which could mean significantly more Democrats being elected to the U.S. Congress. So even though it is a state race we'll be talking about, it still will have major impacts nationally. Also ahead, we will be speaking with former CNN contributor and communications expert Tom Farmer, as we'll be talking about his new book, Bombarded, How to Fight Back Against the Online Assault on Democracy and How to Fight Back Against Disinformation. And boy, we certainly saw a lot of that during last night's debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Now, regarding last night's debate, as expected, the ratings were down pretty significantly. In fact, initial reports show that 21% fewer people watched last night's debate as compared to the first Biden versus Trump debate. And that's bad news for the Trump campaign, because obviously right now he is trailing significantly in the polls, and he's the one that needs to change the trajectory of the race. And as we look more at the debate last night, Donald Trump did what he said he was going to do, which was be more restrained and not interrupt as much as he did during the first debate. He was very well restrained, I would say, for about the first 40 or 45 minutes, but then things certainly did become a little unhinged as the debate went on. Now, as we look at polling after this debate, we're probably going to see the race tighten by 1 or 2 percentage points, because right now Joe Biden is leading in the polls by an average of somewhere between 9 and 10 points, and this is a point or two higher than where he has typically been all summer and all spring. In fact, if we go back to May, Joe Biden has generally had anywhere between a 7 and 8 percentage point lead. Now, it was only recently since Donald Trump contracted COVID that Biden was able to expand that lead to 9 or 10 percentage points. And I would expect a few of those voters who probably did change their mind in the past few weeks to Joe Biden to switch back and go to Donald Trump, or in other words, come back to their usual candidate. It won't be enough to flip the election simply because so much of Biden's support is already baked in, which is very different from what we had in 2016, as I've brought up many times, when we had voters constantly changing their mind between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. So even though the polls might tighten by a point or two, I don't think it'll be because of the debate. It'll mostly be because you have Republican leading voters who eventually will go back to Donald Trump after initially flirting with Joe Biden for the past few weeks. But it will be interesting to see how the Trump campaign frames last night's debate performance to Donald Trump himself. Because if they can say, well, Donald, look at the polls, we were able to tighten things by a percentage point or two, that means if you act more restrained and we have overall just less of you, that's better for you in the polls. But will Donald Trump actually believe that? Because even if the race does tighten by a point or two, he'll still be trailing by a good 7 or 8 percentage points nationally, and really he needs to get those polls down to 5 or 6 points nationally to have any sort of chance at winning the Electoral College. And I could see this leading to Donald Trump going completely unhinged between now and Election Day, where he'll look at some of the political operatives that told him to tone things down and say, well, yeah, I did it your way, and look, the race didn't shift whatsoever. So we could be in for a really interesting next few days of the campaign. All right, let's take a break and come on back and talk about what's happening down in Texas, because what happens in that state in their legislature could have a major impact on U.S. Congress and how many Democrats we could be sending to Congress in the future. So that's coming up next here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So the past few days I've been talking about on the show about some races that I'm going to be watching on election night that probably aren't going to be getting a lot of attention in the national media. I was talking about how I'm watching the North Carolina legislative races, also what's happening in Ohio, but there's another one to watch, and that's what's happening in Texas, where Democrats have a very real chance of retaking the Texas State House of Representatives. Now you might be sitting there and thinking, well, why do I care about what happens in Texas? Well, that could have a massive impact on what happens at the congressional level, being that Texas, of course, is a very large state and is expected to gain even more congressional seats. And if the Texas Dems do have a seat at the table when it comes to redistricting after 2020, that could mean more Democrats in the House of Representatives. So joining us now on the show to tell us about some of these big races in this Texas state legislature is Kendall Scudder. He is the co-host of Pod Bless Texas, which is a podcast dedicated to figuring out how Democrats can turn states like Texas purple. He and co-host Lillian Salerno also are co-founders of Armadillo Strategies, as Kendall joins us now. Hey, Kendall, how you doing today?
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Exciting times down in Texas since, well, prior to 2018, Republicans held a pretty overwhelming majority in the State House of Representatives. But in 2018, Democrats were able to pick up 12 seats. Now I believe they only need to pick up 9 more in 2020 to get a majority. So what are you thinking for Democrats in terms of their chances of flipping the Texas House?
Man, you are completely right. You know, in Texas, the Democrats had been in control of the Texas House for a while. They started these redistricting games back in the early 2000s, where you may remember Tom DeLay ended up in prison. And then in 2010, they just mastered it and ran the map. And we've been spending the last 10 years trying to catch up. But the demographics are shifting so much in Texas that even with districts that are drawn for us to be overwhelmingly behind, it's looking like it's at a point where people are starting to accept the fact that Texas Democrats are about to flip the House. It's about how much are they going to flip it by at this point. And that's a big deal for a couple of reasons. If you aren't from Texas, you may not realize the outsized impact that Texas has on the rest of the country. Like, for instance, we're one of the biggest polluters in the country. Imagine if we could have a legislature that actually dealt with environmental issues. We have a railroad commission race that's up in Texas, too. That is the chief oil and gas regulator, and the Democrat is poised to win that seat as well. And so, you know, that's really exciting. Texas also produces the vast majority of textbooks for the country. So how Texas sets its curriculum tends to impact the rest of the country. So these types of things are stuff that aren't on the front of people's minds, but they probably should be. And they're why flipping the Texas House is so important to people, even outside of Texas.
So you sound pretty optimistic that the Dems have a chance to flip the Texas House. What about on the other side in the Senate? Is there any chance of that possibly going blue as well?
Unfortunately, so I'm a kind of an expert on this one. I actually ran for the Texas Senate in 2018, so I'm very familiar with that body. And unfortunately, in Texas, our Senate districts are so large. I mean, they're the second largest districts in the country. Each state Senate district has about 800,000 to 900,000 people in it. They're bigger than a congressional district. And so the way they've drawn those districts, I mean, that whole body is really hard for us to be able to capture. Our goal in that body is to try to make sure that we pick up enough seats that Dan Patrick won't be able to cram whatever he wants through our Senate body, because Dan Patrick, the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, is the person who oversees the Senate. And so if we're able to pick up, you know, one, two seats, we've suddenly broken his supermajority. So if we're able to do that and flip the Texas House, Texas is starting to look a whole lot different. Also, we have a Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court on the ballot this time as well. So if Texas goes blue, not only would it guarantee a Biden presidency, we could flip the entire judicial chamber by having a Chief Justice and four additional Supreme Court justices. We could flip the Texas House and we can break a supermajority in the Senate. And suddenly Texas isn't this big red stronghold anymore. It is very purple.
And you were talking about a few moments ago some of the other impacts that we, of course, could experience around the country with textbooks and, of course, pollution as well. So certainly some good news if the House does get flipped. But another big impact that, well, big political people like me are following along in the state is, of course, redistricting. Or if the Dems do take the Texas House, that means, well, they have a seat at the table when it comes to redistricting after 2020. And potentially that could mean a lot less gerrymandering in the state. But as you and I were emailing before we came on air, you said the redistricting process is a little bit more complicated in the state than meets the eye. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know... So if we flip the Texas House, that means that we will have a Democrat as the speaker, hopefully, right? Assuming that the Democrats don't get caught with their pants around their ankles. So if that is able to happen, that would mean we would have one seat on what Texas calls the redistricting board. Our redistricting board consists of the lieutenant governor, the land commissioner, the AG, and the speaker of the House. And so those are the people who end up drawing the districts if we aren't able to draw them during a legislative session. Federal districts are required to be drawn by the legislature. So what this means is that our federal districts would not make it to a redistricting board. They would have to be drawn by a Democratic state house signed off on by the governor. And if we cannot accomplish that during our legislative session, which ends in June of 21, then it would go to the courts, which I think is probably best case scenario at this point, because the governor is not going to sign off on maps that come through. However, our state districts are not required to be drawn by the legislature. So if we can't get our state districts through during the legislature, that will go to the redistricting board, of which, unfortunately, you're looking at 4 or 5 Republicans to 1 Democrat if we flip the chamber. So our goal, I think, down here is to try to get every map we can into the courts to get drawn instead of having it drawn by the legislature. But then there are 2 more kind of crazy wild hairs there to pay attention to. One is census data. We don't know when we're going to get it now because of the COVID-19 outbreak and all the Trump shenanigans on the census. So if we don't get census data until October of next year, our legislature has already met and adjourned. We only meet once every 2 years. And so there would be no opportunity for us to draw the ballots even before the next election. So that would be really strange. The second wild hair is, like I said earlier, we have a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court on the ballot. And if we end up electing a Democrat there, we've got a different ball game when we go to the courts and we're fighting over our redistricting map.
So a lot to unpack there. Let's start talking about this the Supreme Court election that you were just mentioning. So tell us about the candidates who are running for that. Is there a good chance that the Dems could potentially pick up that Chief Justice seat?
Yeah, right now the candidate, her name is Amy Clark Meacham. She's a judge out of Travis County, which is Austin. You know, some people don't consider that Texas, but I like to. And so she's not only is she a qualified jurist, she also is the first woman to ever even run for that seat. No woman has ever even run for Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court. And so she's a really interesting candidate. And, you know, we've all seen the polls where Biden is tied sometimes up to, sometimes down to in Texas. If Biden ends up having some huge down ballot repercussions from carrying Texas or even getting close, some really qualified candidates could end up winning even if Biden loses. And if that happens, you know, it sucks. You know, obviously we'd love for Biden to be able to win the state, but if we could pick up a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and a seat on the Railroad Commission to regulate oil and gas in the state and flip the state house, I'd call that a win in Texas, even if we don't get the Electoral College. The Supreme Court seat, the Texas House, and then that seat on the Railroad Commission, you know, it sets us up to play a very different game in 2022. I know that that gives everyone a headache to think about having to have another election in 22. But, you know, for those of us who are constantly in this fight, you always got to think about the next election cycle and what that means. And so being able to make some headway in 2020 really puts us in a good spot for 22, where we'll be able to take on Dan Patrick, who's everyone's least favorite person.
Yeah, and as we've said in a previous conversation, he's one of the most powerful people in the state of Texas, even though he's the lieutenant governor and not the actual governor. So he certainly has some outsized power. And yeah, if you get a chance to take him out in 2022, that would certainly be some good news.
Oh, absolutely. So in Texas, the lieutenant governor gets to steer all legislation through the Senate, and they can block and refuse things to committee. And so, yeah, the governor's important because they sign off on everything that was passed, but literally nothing can get passed unless the lieutenant governor says he's okay with it. So, you know, we took a good run at it in the last election, 18, nearly beat the guy. I mean, our candidate against Dan Patrick actually won or performed better than Beto O'Rourke in 174 of our counties. And so, you know, people here don't like Dan Patrick much. And so 22 is a really good opportunity, especially how they bungled this COVID response.
And if I remember correctly, didn't he end up saying something really stupid when the pandemic was just beginning here in 2020? I can't remember the exact quote, but I remember it making some national news.
Oh, yeah. He was the guy who said that some of us seniors are going to have to sacrifice ourselves for the good of the economy.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Another reason to hopefully get rid of that guy in the coming years.
I think the actual quote was, there are more important things than living.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I remember that getting picked up everywhere back. What was it, like March or April? Hey, I want to circle back and talk about redistricting, because you were bringing up just a few minutes ago how, well, if we don't have the census data in by October of 2021, well, by that point, the Texas legislature will have adjourned. So if that's the case and the legislature only meets once every 2 years, what kind of districts would we have in the 2022 elections?
I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question. What everybody is really concerned about right now is Republicans have shown that they have no boundaries when it comes to what they are willing to do to throw down to get their way. And so there are a lot of different options that could happen. And, you know, I'm one of those people that I'm personally worried that the Democrats are not going to fight hard enough. You know, I'm not always saying you need to be the most progressive person in the room, but I do think you need to have a backbone of steel, regardless of whether you're a mainstream or a progressive. You know, there's a scenario that could happen where, let's say the Democrats split the House and the Republicans are worried about what they may do in redistricting, and if we flip the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court too, Greg Abbott could, according to our Constitution, call a special session and try to draw these maps before the new legislature gets put into place in January and before he even has census data. So, I mean, who knows what these people are going to do? I think that Amy Coney Barrett has shown us just how ruthless they are. And it's probably time for the Democrats to start being that ruthless too, because that's the only way we're going to be able to survive.
I'm with you on that. Yeah, if they were to call some sort of special session during November and December of this year and jam something through in a two-month window, I mean, 10 years ago, that would have sounded unbelievable and politicos would have laughed you out of the room. But you're right, that could very well happen with the precedent we've had set under our current president with Donald Trump. Yeah, I wouldn't put it past Republicans to try to do that, to say, well, we don't want to have the Dems to have a seat at the table. Let's just draw our own districts.
Well, especially if they have a United States Supreme Court that is a political mechanism instead of jurists. you know, whatever they do here could go to a Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will probably side with the Republicans because the Supreme Court is now a political body. Thank you, Donald Trump. I mean, that's, it's really scary. You know, just kind of from a, more of a 50,000 foot point of view, I know this isn't Texas specific, but, you know, our problem as Democrats right now is that we're the adults in the room, and nobody likes your mom when she tells you you can't get candy at the grocery store, and everybody loves dad when he tells you you can eat a gallon of ice cream for dinner. The problem is that gallon of ice cream for dinner isn't good for you, and mom is the one that's looking out for you. And Democrats are kind of in that place right now where we're the responsible ones trying to get good things done and fix government, while Republicans are tantruming and tirading and getting whatever they want. And it's just hard for us to compete unless we start to put ourselves in a position where, you know, we're ready to throw down for what's important.
We're speaking with Kendall Scudder. He is the co-host of Pod Bless Texas, which is a podcast dedicated to figuring out how Democrats can turn states like Texas purple. So talking more about these legislative races, Kendall, and of course that big Supreme Court race, what are some of the successful campaigns doing to try to get out the vote and flip these seats that you've been seeing? Is it the fact that they're either progressive or moderate, or is it coming down to their campaign strategy or what they're doing on social media? At least as you've been observing things down there, what are some of the successful campaigns doing?
You know, we are still learning in Texas what it looks like to be in a state that's in play. You know, Texas is so expensive for people to compete in that, I mean, honestly, if there isn't a, when they say Biden's putting $6 million in Texas, to everyone else, that sounds like a lot. To us, it's like, great, where's the rest? Because, you know, Better or Worse spent $80 million. So for us to really compete here, it's super expensive. So we aren't used to these types of elections. So we're seeing a lot of media buys. I mean, if you turn on the television right now, it's nothing but political commercials, which is very new to us. I think for the most part, the more kind of mainstream Democratic candidates won their primary, with a couple of exceptions. But we're not really seeing results of that play out too much electorally. You know, some polling that I've seen internally shows that, you know, the candidates that are super progressive are performing maybe just a little bit worse than the mainstream ones, but not super consequentially. So, I mean, we won't know that for sure. Polls are just a snapshot in time, so we won't know until election day. But, I mean, in the era of COVID, especially for our statewide candidates or our candidates with really big districts, there's a little bit of a blessing snuck in there. And it's that you don't have to travel this massive state. You know, it's El Paso is closer to Los Angeles than it is Beaumont, Texas. And so to get around this state, it's just, it's an undertaking. Well, now you can do all of these Zoom events and go all over the state in one day to raise money or to do events for clubs or whatever. And, you know, no one's expecting you to do that level of travel. And so I think that there's a little bit of a built-in advantage there for a party that's trying to be an insurgent party that's not currently in power. That being said, you know, if you're running in a tough district or one that's going to be close, which I guess that's in 2018, the district that we may have lost by 15 points is now one that's kind of close just because of the way Donald Trump shifted the electorate. I think those people are at the biggest disadvantage because they don't have the opportunity to go face to face with people. And that's how you persuade people the best. So I think it's a mixed bag and everybody's dealing with what they can. I think a closing point on that is that any Democrat who thinks that the Republicans are just sitting at home playing on Zoom like we are, they are very, very wrong and very mistaken. Republicans have robust field programs in Texas this cycle. They are knocking on doors. They are going to community events. They do not care how many people they get sick. And so I've been telling every Democratic candidate I can, you better put you and your team in masks. You better learn how far 6 feet is by eyeballing it and get your tail end out to some events. Because we've got to start meeting people. We can't just sit around and let the Republicans be the only ones that are doing face-to-face.
Couple more questions for you here, Kendall. And as I've been reading what's happening down in Texas with your elections this year, one of the big changes that was made during this cycle as compared to 2018 was that straight ticket voting was eliminated. And as I was reading through, Republicans were saying, well, that's a reason why Democrats did so well in 2018. What do you make about straight ticket voting being eliminated and its impact it could have on this fall's elections?
Yeah, you know, there are some states that don't have straight ticket voting, so I'm not going to pretend like it's the end of the world. But if it were not advantageous to Democrats, Republicans would not have tried to get rid of it. That's it. When they can't win elections, they try to rig it in their favor. And so they change the rules. The reason that we had this straight ticket voting here is because you'll have places like Houston or Dallas. We elect judges here in Texas, so you may end up with a ballot that's 20 pages long. And these people down at the bottom of the ballot, you know, there's a lot of drop-off. So Republicans have seen that they can't win some of these judicials in urban areas and tried to eliminate it in hopes that the Democrats would have drop-off and wouldn't fill in the straight party oval. I think it's going to hurt them a little bit in some areas that they don't expect it, though. You know, in some of these rural areas, these people who are showing up for Donald Trump, they don't care about the other Republicans on the ballot. You know, why would any person voting for Donald Trump even know the name of their congressperson? A lot of them are people that are just now tuning in, or they're folks that, you know, as Donald Trump says, they don't have the same level of education as a lot of other voters. They're showing up for Donald Trump. And so if there's not a Republican button there, maybe they're going to drop off on the ballots too. In some of these rural areas, they're on paper ballots. So they actually have to go through the ballot, whereas in some of these urban areas, we've moved to electronic paper hybrids where you are not allowed to get through your vote until you've hit next on every button, right? So, I mean, that should help us with some of the drop-off. But yeah, I mean, it's not ideal. We'd certainly love to have it back. That, mixed with the shenanigans that Ken Paxton, our attorney general, has been playing with mail-in ballots down here, it's very scary. I foresee a situation in Texas where maybe we get really close, but we don't quite win it. And as each day passes, ballots are starting to be counted for mail-ins, and then we start to pull ahead. And all these Republicans are going to start screaming about mail-in fraud. And when that's absolutely not the case, it's just people's ballots take time to get counted when they're mailed in. And then maybe Greg Abbott and Ken Paxton start trying to shut down every single ballot counting location that they can and start trying to throw out people's mail-in ballots. I mean, that's terrifying, but I would not put it beneath them at this point. The Republican Party today is not the Republican Party they were. I'm a East Texas guy that grew up on a farm. You know, I am a perfect demo for a Republican. And I mean, I used to be going back and forth here in Texas. I would play, you know, sometimes I'd vote for Republicans, usually not, but sometimes. But nowadays, they've gone so crazy. People like me, or maybe people a little more moderate than me, we're not touching those guys anymore. And so they're just going to do what they can to rig the election and try to win it. And we have to make sure we have the best attorneys and the best poll watchers and the best volunteers to try to hold them accountable.
Yeah, and you brought up such a good point there because, yeah, well, not only might Donald Trump try to steal the election, although I'm a little skeptical that could actually happen, but it's some of these down-ballot races where, yeah, if you have Republicans in power, they very well might try to steal some of these down-ballot elections. Kendall, we're down to just a few minutes. I got one more question for you. So if we're looking for any bellwethers for these Texas state house races, are there any specific districts that we should be watching on election night that would give us a pretty good indication as to how the Texas House might go?
Yeah, I think it depends on what tier of race you're wanting to look at. I think right now the New York Times is talking about one of the top 10 bellwether counties in the country being Collin County, Texas, which is a suburb just north of Dallas, contains Frisco, Texas, one of the fastest growing cities in America. There's a congressional district there where Lulu Cycli is running against Van Taylor. Wasn't thought to be a district that was winnable. It's the most educated district in the country that's still held by a Republican. If Lulu is able to pull that one off, Oh, goodness, it's going to be a great night. There are two state House districts there that are really well in play. If Sharon Hirsch in House District 66 performs well, it's going to be a really good night, too. And then there's House District 67, which is directly next to Sharon Hirsch, where Lorenzo Sanchez is running. He is one of the really progressive candidates that made it out of their primary. So watching them directly next to each other in the same county will be interesting, because Sharon Hirsch's district and his district are relatively similar. It's just she's more of a mainstream Democrat and he's more of a progressive Democrat. And that'll kind of show you what the difference is between the progressive candidates and the mainstream candidates. And then in other areas of the state, you know, some of these college towns, I think, are worth watching. So, a lot of people probably won't tell you that, and if you're not from Texas, you may not realize it. But places like like College Station, where Texas A&M is, there's a candidate running there in House District 14. Beto O'Rourke almost won that district, and we're in a presidential this year. Students are going to be turning out in droves. I think we might pick up some rural seats that have large colleges in them. So House District 14 with Janet Dunning will be an interesting one to watch, and John Gibson up in Lubbock running in the Texas Tech District. That one's a little bit harder, but if he's able to, you know, perform relatively well, maybe in the mid to high 40s, I mean, it is game over for Republicans here. And so I think then you have candidates like, Brandi Chambers running in House District 112, just a killer candidate coming back for a second bite at the apple. It's probably the hardest district for Democrats to win inside of Dallas County. But I think she's going to be able to carry that one. She's been working her tail end off. So, you know, there are really great candidates that we have all around the state. They're all working hard and doing very locally specific messaging, and particularly messaging on Medicaid expansion, because we still haven't expanded Medicaid in Texas. You know, I think it's going to be I'm very optimistic that it's going to be a good night for Democrats. I'm hoping it's going to be a great night for Democrats.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hoping so, too. And yeah, you certainly did give us some races that I'll at least be keeping an eye on as I'm doing my election night coverage here on AM 950. We've been speaking with Kendall Scudder. He's the co-host of the podcast called Pod Bless Texas, which is the podcast dedicated to figuring out how Democrats can turn states like Texas purple. He's also the co-founder of Armadillo Strategies. Hey, Kendall, really appreciate the time today and giving us a rundown of what's happening in a very, very important state this year.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you. And we're watching y'all up in Minnesota, too. Y'all better carry it across for Biden. We need you guys.
And stick around. We'll come on back and have more on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So a few days ago on my show, I was talking about this very shocking poll that was released that showed a little over half of Donald Trump supporters believe all or some of the QAnon conspiracy theory that says that top Democrats are involved in a child sex trafficking ring. Obviously, QAnon is completely false, but a large portion of the population believes in that conspiracy theory. And that's just one example. We, of course, do live in an era of disinformation, especially with personalized social media and personalized internet searches with how we go and consume our news. So joining us to talk more about this, how we got to this point of disinformation and what we can do to combat and try to move to, well, more sane political discussions based on facts. We're joined by Tom Farmer. He is a veterans communications professional, also a former CNN journalist and author of the brand new book just released, Bombarded, How to Fight Back Against the Online Assault on Democracy. He wrote that along with Cyrus Krohn, who is the former publisher of Slate. So, Tom, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Brett, thank you very much for having me on. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, let's start off with QAnon, because this is something that's just fascinated me for so long, even before QAnon kind of made its way into the mainstream and over the past few months, where it's just been this wild conspiracy theory that has just gained so much traction, despite the fact that it's so easy to prove it's false. How do we get to this point where something like this, and I don't just even necessarily mean QAnon, but any conspiracy theory or any amount of fake news moves its way into the mainstream?
Right, right. The first thing to know about QAnon is that it is professionally engineered lunacy. It is a conspiracy theory which has the very same rhythms and template as conspiracy theories have shown us for 100 years or more. You go back to anti-Semitic conspiracies in the early years of the 20th century, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's the very same rhythms. Outlandish UFO theories have some of the same flavor. They're built to appeal to a certain personality type. What's different today, Brett, is that that material is no longer sequestered in the speculation section in the back of the bookshop. It is front and center on the internet alongside conventional credible news, and it's hard to tell the difference. It can be styled to look like conventional news. It's on YouTube with conventional news, and we have no more reliable narrators in the information sphere to help us differentiate one from the other.
So how did we get to this point? Did it just start with, well, basically the invention of the internet and the fact that anyone can put something out on a platform, whether it be YouTube or social media? Or could it go even a little deeper than that? Because I'm thinking about how personalized, like, your news feed would be on Facebook or even Twitter. Talk about that aspect a little bit.
Well, you know, we've always had the ability to access crazy information or fringe information. You know, it's never been off limits. But the internet is special. It changes the architecture of information so that people can paper their walls 24/7 with material that pleases them and feeds their predispositions. And the algorithms behind news feeds and whatnot are built to give you more of what you want. So, Brett, if you believe in your heart of hearts that the Nazis are operating a secret moon base and always have, and you subscribe to this and you dig into enough YouTube videos and material which supports this conspiracy, your life will pretty soon be filled with Nazi moon base stuff, and you'll see less and less news about the COVID-19 pandemic. It takes over your headspace. The internet is built to reinforce that kind of compartmentalization. It's as if we are all zooming along in individual space capsules through the void, disconnected from one another, and all the screens on each of our capsules are festooned with information that caters to our biases and preconceptions. And we have a difficult time seeing out the window and seeing what's really out there.
We're speaking with Tom Farmer. He is the author, or one of the authors, of the brand new book. It is called Bombarded: How to Fight Back Against the Online Assault on Democracy. As they're talking about, well, the disinformation age that we live in right now, and even looking more historically at this, Tom, it almost seems like we're in an era right now where it's easier to spread disinformation. Obviously, it's not the first time this has happened, as we've certainly had. I mean, looking at previous examples, we went into the Iraq War under false pretenses back in 2002 and 2003. We have numerous examples before social media was invented of people being manipulated by disinformation. But I think what really makes this era a lot different is that it's just so much easier to do now with social media, as you were talking about, with algorithms where they can personalize what you're receiving on your news feed, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, or another platform.
Yeah, it's a low-cost way to destabilize a belief system or wreak havoc with a political process. I mean, Brett, you're right. We've had propaganda, you know, for centuries. You go back and look at old Soviet Stalinist era posters they used to hang in Red Square to convince the Russian people they were number one in everything. That was pretty primitive compared to convincing millions of people today that satanic pedophiles are undermining the government and running the Democratic Party. They are equally open to challenge, you know, but a lot more people believe it this way. The internet, as we said, is almost designed so well to accommodate this kind of material. It's as if it was built for it. And yet, to go back to the early days, this is not what people thought would happen at all. One of the themes in the book is that we who worked in the internet in the 1990s when the consumer World Wide Web came into being had no idea that it would end up this dysfunctional.
So what should we be asking of our tech providers? Or I even like the term I think you used in the book as I was looking through the description, big data. What should we be asking of them to try to prevent the spread of disinformation? Is it as simple as just saying, well, like what Twitter and Facebook are doing, we'll put a caption saying this contains false information. Here's a link to where you can find actual facts on whatever you're reading about. What role do you think big tech and big data should be playing in terms of trying to combat this?
Well, it's important to realize that for most of their lives, big tech has run screaming from this responsibility. The ethical backbone that used to drive American journalism, that drives your radio station, the compulsion to try and get things right and filter the junk from the candy, all of that. All of those guideposts are missing from tech culture. They just wanted to make a lot of money. Own eyeballs, make bank, break things, keep moving. Now you've come to a stage where big tech is no longer just breaking up taxi companies and Borders bookstores with new innovations. They're actually breaking democracy itself by destroying our shared view of reality. So the question is, what do you do to hold those platform providers to account? And in truth, if there is a sustained profanity on your air, or if you allow too many people to get past the 7-second delay and start screaming diatribes, you will eventually get a call from the FCC because you're using the public airwaves and you're responsible for that material. Not so much at Facebook and Twitter, and they have a dodge in the legal language which allows them to purvey this material, pocket the profits, but not take responsibility. It's time that dodge got a second look.
So at least on the consumer end, what can we do to combat disinformation? Is it as easy as just, well, unplugging from social media? What do you say about that in terms of us as consumers? What can we do?
Well, the simplest step that everybody can take is to examine the provenance and content of the material that you forward and share with friends as closely as some people examine the soup cans at the supermarket. I know people who scrutinize every box of rice to see what the carb and sodium content is and whether they want that in their system, but pass on junk news to one another and to their friends' network without a second thought because they want to believe it, because the content, spurious or real, drives their belief system forward, conforms with their preconceptions. Let's stop doing that. Look at the URL for the material that you're reading. Look at the author's name. See if the author has a background. See if the stuff is spelled right. A lot of the disinformation out of Eastern Europe is fractured English. It's pretty easy to spot, like phishing emails. Look and see if there is a motive at work, whether this material is showing red flags regarding trustworthiness. You can capture 90% of the junk just with a little bit of scrutiny up front, which most people don't do.
So in other words, you're talking about the very simple but important concept of critical thinking, something that I think is a lost art that a lot of people don't unfortunately do anymore. And I like that you are taking this angle rather than just saying, well, social media company, or you can just delete your social media, or social media companies can censor these posts, because that almost makes it spread more like wildfire in terms of people thinking, well, I mean, just use the example of the Hunter Biden story in the New York Post, where when people see that it's getting censored by Facebook and Twitter, it just encourages them more to check out that piece of check out what was written by the New York Post, where I like the idea of what you're bringing up, which is just simply critical thinking.
Well, critical thinking is I hesitate to say it's a lost art, Brent, but it's certainly endangered because of the behavior the internet has encouraged for 25 years to just let it wash over you. To your point about the Hunter Biden thing, you know, there's a huge difference between censorship and editing. Your newsroom doesn't just put everything on the air. You know, if I call them up and say I've got proof of the Nazi moon base, they're going to say, oh, wait a minute, Tom, it doesn't sound like it holds water. That's not censorship. That is filtering. And we used to have a cadre of reliable narrators in this country in the form of conventional journalists who acted as gatekeepers and made sure that the what got on was generally true and credible. We don't have that anymore. And now people have to do it themselves until we can get more permanent structural reforms into place to hold the platform operators responsible for what they post.
So as we look at our elected officials, do they really even have that much of an incentive to try to stop the flow of disinformation from big tech? I mean, I think about it from the perspective of those, especially on the right wing, who have benefited from disinformation, especially in the Trump era. Or if we look at politicians from all sides of the aisle, let's be honest, they get a lot of money from big tech. So again, what incentive do politicians have to even try to curb the flow of disinformation?
Yeah, it's a great question because there are people running for Congress right now, likely to win, who are big QAnon believers and who would tell you if they were the third voice in this interview that suppressing QAnon material is censorship and anti-American. That is not my view and not a lot of people's view, but that would be their case. The force that works is public pressure. People who are up for re-election every 2 years are incredibly sensitive to what the public is telling them. And if we could create a public groundswell for moderate regulation of tech platform providers, plus a civics initiative to instill the kind of critical thinking that you were just talking about, that would have an enormously positive effect.
Well, the name of the book is Bombarded, How to Fight Back Against the Online Assault on Democracy, as we've been speaking with one of the authors of that book, Tom Farmer. You can find the book again, Bombarded, How to Fight Back Against the Online Assault on Democracy, wherever books are sold, including, of course, one of our sponsors, Next Chapter Booksellers. So I encourage you to go check that out, especially if you were a fan of the movie The Social Dilemma. This really takes even a deeper look than they did at disinformation in our modern political age. Hey, Tom, really appreciate the time today.
It's a pleasure, Brett. Thank you for the great questions, and thanks for having me in.
Again, I encourage you to check out Tom's new book, Bombarded, How to Fight Back Against the Online Assault on Democracy. You can find that over at Next Chapter Booksellers. That's about all the time I got for my show today. Matt McNeil is up next.